good morning and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. Coming up in this half hour, nearly 500,000 women who are refugees or internally displaced by the war in Syria are pregnant. With facilities and medical care hard to come by, Washingtonians are doing their part to help these women and their babies. We'll hear comments from Rita Zoeda, the executive director of the Salaam Cultural Museum. Research shows toddlers who speak more than one language are better at certain cognitive tasks than children who speak just one language. Bilingual speakers continue to benefit into adulthood when they can use their language skills to increase job opportunities. Bridget Yadin is professor of Hispanic Studies at the University of Concordia in Montreal and a mother of a third grader. We'll hear her comments in just a few minutes. In the second half of the show, Salem correspondent Chris Lehman talks with Oregon Representative Vic Gilliam. Gilliam represents District 18. Last November, he announced his diagnosis of ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. Gilliam has said he would serve as long as his conditions allowed. A short and very contentious session in the Oregon legislature is testing that resolve. But first, we'll hear from Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins. 5 years ago, a Washington prison guard was murdered. Inmate Byron Scherf strangled Officer Jamie Bendel while she was working alone. Last week, almost 5 years to the day, another Washington State correctional officer is recovering at home after a vicious assault. This latest incident is renewing questions about staffing levels inside Washington's prisons.
It was Monday morning, January 25th, at Clallam Bay Correction Center on the Olympic Peninsula. Little did Officer Terry Breedlove know, but an inmate on his unit had managed to remove the top of a metal stool inside his cell. As Officer Breedlove passed by the cell door on a check of the tier, the inmate suddenly attacked.
He exited his cell with the stool's top and struck the officer repeatedly.
That's Brian King with the Clallam County Sheriff's Office. He says other inmates stopped the attack and summoned help, but not before Officer Breedlove suffered serious head wounds.
It's a brutal assault.
The day after, one of Breedlove's colleagues, Joshua Reyes, testified before a panel of state lawmakers in Olympia. He related the story of accompanying Breedlove to the hospital.
Yesterday, I had the disheartening task of riding in the back of an ambulance with a call worker and a friend who was blindsided and brutally attacked with a metal stool by an inmate, causing him 14 staples to the back of his skull and 12 stitches above his eye, where he was hit 6 times.
The attack on Breedlove comes 2 years after another officer at Clallam Bay was stabbed in the face and neck by an inmate. Michelle Woodrow is president of Teamsters Local 117 that represents prison workers. She says these assaults raise serious questions about prison staffing levels.
It highlights that the system is broken when we have to rely on offenders to intervene when one of our members is being assaulted. And that's exactly what happened here.
5 years ago, there was no one around to save Officer Jamie Bendel. That's when inmate Byron Scherf slipped into the chapel at Monroe Correction Center and strangled Bendel with an amplifier cable. Bendel was working alone in an area without cameras. After her death, the Washington legislature passed a prison safety measure. Officers are now armed with pepper spray and emergency call buttons on their radio mics. Camera systems are also being upgraded. But those extra protections weren't enough for Officer Breedlove. It appears he didn't have time to call for help or deploy his pepper spray, and the camera in the area where he was attacked wasn't working. Woodrow of the Teamsters Union says that shows tools and technology aren't enough to keep officers safe.
The best scenario would be that there's another officer in that living unit with Officer Breedlove that could alert quicker, that could come to his aid, that could be of assistance.
Officer Breedlove was in charge of supervising approximately 100 medium security inmates housed on 2 tiers of cells with an open recreation area. While other officers were on duty in the vicinity, he was at a single officer post. Steve Sinclair is head of prisons for Washington's Department of Corrections. He says this staffing model is typical in prisons.
There's many instances when a correctional officer performing their duties doesn't have a partner immediately by their side.
The overall staffing model for Washington prisons hasn't changed in more than 25 years. After the death of Jamie Bendel, the legislature did fund an additional 25 officers for medium security units across the system. Also, each prison now has a full-time safety specialist. Sinclair says there's an opportunity to learn from what happened to Officer Breedlove.
I hope that if there are any gaps, they're able to be identified through our review process. And I hope Terry gets better and continues to be the dedicated and exceptional employee that he is.
Washington prison officials will soon get an independent report on safety and security behind bars. The state auditor's office is currently wrapping up a performance audit that looks at steps that have been taken to protect prison staff and that will recommend what more can be done. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
Syria will enter its fifth year of a civil war next month, and since the fighting started, nearly 4 million refugees have fled across the country's borders. The displaced refugees end up in camps in bordering countries such as Jordan and Turkey, where medical supplies are hard to come by, especially for pregnant women and newborn babies. Although the needs of babies born in these refugee camps may seem distant to North Coast residents, Rita Zawaida, who runs the Salaam Cultural Museum in Seattle, is providing a local solution.
Kits are put together by us here in our office, in the Seattle office, and we just ask for donations of everything that needs to go into a kit. It's given to a mother that has just delivered, and it will be items that a mother would need from the first day of delivery of a baby up to 1 year of age.
Zoeda says her organization sent about 200 kits to a refugee camp in Jordan 6 months ago, and the museum's medical missions program is in the process of making more. The museum also received quilts for babies from knitters across the nation. According to the United Nations, nearly 500,000 Syrian refugees and internally displaced women are pregnant. For children born in Syria, the conditions are especially harsh because of the lack of reliable facilities. Zoeda, whose organization also sends prenatal vitamins and baby formula to refugee camps, describes some of the conditions expectant mothers face.
With poor access to water facilities and hygiene, there's so many infections and premature deliveries. And she wants her baby, so, you know, anything that we were able to give them.
After the Paris attacks in November raised security concerns over refugees from the Middle East, 31 governors vowed to close their states to people resettling in the U.S. Washington Governor Jay Inslee was vocal about doing the opposite, saying his state would embrace compassion and equality. Rita says she sees that sentiment among many people.
That they are bringing high chairs and booster seats and bringing clothes in and bringing in games for the kids and all the stuff that we can turn around and hand out to people. You know, Washington has absolutely been fantastic.
You're listening to The Bridge. Idaho has not been a big player in the oil and gas industry so far, but a new bill approved in a Senate committee last week could speed up Idaho's energy production. It would shorten the time for appeals to new energy applications. A group critical of oil and gas production in Idaho rallied on the steps of the State House this week. Frankie Barnhill has the report.
Alma Hassey says the bill could spell problems for people who lease their land to companies. Hassey is with Citizens Allied for Integrity and Accountability, which held Monday's rally. She says the bill could make it harder for people who own land but who don't own the mineral rights on that land to control what happens on their property. Hassey also cautions against depleting Idaho's water supply. Hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, is the process used to get gas trapped under the earth and is water intensive.
We're an ag state, and you know our irrigation water is the lifeblood of our agriculture. And if it starts being sold to the highest bidder, you know, we're going to have farm ground going fallow and we're going to have farmers going out of business.
She says the group is trying to stop the bill from advancing beyond the Senate. Reporting in Boise, I'm Frankie Barnhill.
Construction is underway in Portland using a new material called cross-laminated timber. Albina Yard is a new office building going up in the northeast area of the city. The four-story, 16,000-square-foot structure has a wood frame laminated with glue rather than traditional metal framing. Wood for the project was milled at D.R. Johnson Lumber in the Douglas County of Riddle. Speaking on the job site last week, Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley said he was reminded of his father's career as a millwright in Riddle after World War II.
That area down there is the heart of Douglas fir timber country. We know that if this strategy spreads, that we're going to make terrific buildings and build a terrific new timber economy to add to the one that we already have.
Merkley and his colleague, Senator Ron Wyden, worked to secure a $120,000 economic development grant to explore whether cross-laminated timber might be a way to revive rural Oregon's timber industry. The Portland project is on schedule for completion this summer. In other news, a new study of bilingual and monolingual toddlers could be reason for Oregon parents to share this story in two languages. Research in the Journal of Experimental Child Psychology shows children learning two languages perform better at certain problem-solving tasks than their monolingual peers. Christina Crivello, who leads the study, says 1.5-year-old bilingual children have abilities that are beneficial for people at any age.
It's these specific cognitive abilities like selective attention and cognitive flexibility, where they have to focus on relevant information and ignore distracting information.
Though there is no consensus yet on exactly how learning other languages improves the brain, Crivello suggests that switching between languages mirrors the process of switching between tasks. Speaking another language can also improve children's chances of getting a job later in life, both at home and abroad. Bridget Yadin, whose third grader is enrolled in a dual immersion language program, says her son will be able to bring another set of skills to potential employers. And those employers could be in any number of countries around the world.
Just the general ability to learn a second language or a third language, he could really go anywhere and be more open to the different cultural practices and really kind of make his way.
Young children immersed in other languages can more easily pick them up because their brains are more receptive to acquiring language. Yadin, who also teaches foreign languages, says she can see how fast her son is progressing compared to her college students.
He's definitely leaps and bounds beyond where my college students who may have had the same amount of time with the language are. He's definitely progressed much more quickly.
Yadin, who is fluent in Spanish, said she didn't study a foreign language until high school. Oregon and Washington state lawmakers are making another try at introducing a new crop to the Northwest. Industrial hemp is the benign cousin of marijuana. Correspondent Tom Bonsi has more on the story.
For the fourth year in a row, the Washington legislature is considering whether to legalize hemp farming. The initial lopsided votes in favor suggest this might be the session it happens. Elijah Eichmeyer is a fourth grader from Chimicum, Washington. He traveled to Olympia with his dad to lobby for passage.
If the whole world used hemp, then that could replace plastic and other non-biodegradable products. This would help my generation to have a healthy future.
Oregon lawmakers approved hemp farming in 2009, but it took until last year to grant the first grower and handler permits, and then just 9 hemp fields were planted. Now Oregon lawmakers are rewriting the strict rules to give potential hemp farmers more flexibility and head off conflicts with marijuana growers. I'm Tom Bonsi reporting.
Industrial hemp and marijuana belong to the same plant species. They can cross-pollinate if grown near each other, which can make the resulting crops unmarketable. Hemp produces oilseed and fiber that processors turn into a wide range of goods, from clothing and food to body care products. Several hemp advocates testified this week in separate public hearings in Salem and Olympia that the plant can be used in building construction. Hemp products are legal to sell in the United States, but the plant itself has long been lumped together with marijuana as an illegal drug by the federal government. Lately, the United States Drug Enforcement Administration has not interfered with commercial hemp cultivations in states such as Kentucky and Colorado that have introduced the crop under state oversight. You're listening to The Bridge. A few short months from now, federal and state foresters around the West will purposely set controlled burns to reduce the risk of catastrophic wildfire later. This is a regular practice in Oregon, Idaho, and California, but much less common in Washington state. Correspondent Tom Bonsi reports from Olympia on efforts to change that.
Land managers in Idaho fight fire with fire nearly twice or three times as often as in neighboring Washington, and that's small potatoes compared to Oregon, which has seen way more acreage purposely burned than any of its neighbors on average over the past 6 years. The point of prescribed burns is to reduce fuel loads with a controlled, low-intensity fire. Yes, that creates smoke, acknowledges State Senator Linda Evans-Parlett, who represents wildfire-ravaged north-central Washington.
I have to tell you, I say, how do we want our smoke?
Do you want it in small batches in spring and fall, or a smothering blanket for 30 straight days at the height of the summer tourist season?
The huge economic impact of the fires and the smoke and so forth, we are still not recovered from.
The Wenatchee Republican says she's uncertain why Washington lags far behind other Western states on this wildfire control strategy. She's pushing several bills that focus on changing policy at Washington's Department of Natural Resources to maximize burn days. I'm Tom Bonsi in Olympia.
In Washington state, a prescribed burn requires a permit from the Department of Natural Resources. According to Wildfire Division Assistant Manager Karen Arnold, they approve about 85% of those permits. A recent report commissioned by the National Association of State Foresters and the Coalition of Prescribed Fire Councils identified three top impediments nationally standing in the way of increased control burning: weather, such as drought and narrow burn windows; capacity issues, such as limited personnel, training, or equipment to manage controlled burns; and smoke complaints, which can be because drifting smoke is a nuisance or because it represents a serious air quality violation. Last week, the Washington Senate National Resources and Parks Committee considered a raft of fire policy changes. One provision, sponsored by Parlett, would limit the discretion of state forest wardens to refuse or revoke a burn permit unless there was a clear evidence of impending violation of air quality standards or an imminent threat to public health and safety. A second statute change aims to shift state policy to explicitly support, quote, mechanical thinning and prescribed burning when appropriate for forest health improvement and fire prevention. This is The Bridge on Coast Community Radio. Last November, a longtime Oregon state representative announced he's facing a likely diagnosis of ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. Vic Gilliam said he would continue to serve as long as his conditions allowed. The current 5-week session of the Oregon legislature is putting that promise to the test. Salem correspondent talked with Representative Gilliam and has this report.
To understand how quickly ALS has taken a toll on Vic Gilliam, you only need to listen. Here he is making a floor speech just last June.
I wonder if there is a compromise in the Dash 17.
And here's what he sounds like now.
I have no reason to doubt all of us are committed to improving.
The 62-year-old Republican from Silverton knows he sounds different.
Your listeners may have already picked up on the fact that your speech can become slurred and slower. That's been an adjustment.
Another adjustment? Gilliam needs a cane to get around the halls of the Capitol. It was actually a fellow lawmaker who first noticed Gilliam's symptoms late in the 2015 session and suggested he get them checked out. Months after that, he got the news. He was facing a likely diagnosis of ALS. The neurological disorder attacks cells that control the muscles and is considered fatal. While it's hard to definitively diagnose, Gilliam went public with his condition in November.
I just wanted to be upfront and start the planning. How do you continue to be effective? Or at what point do you say, maybe I gotta step down and let somebody else?
Gilliam says he's not at that point yet. This session, he's continued work on two of his longtime causes, elder abuse prevention and getting a statue of the late U.S. Senator Mark Hatfield installed in the U.S. Capitol. Gilliam is also known around Salem for his offbeat humor. Democratic Representative Brian Clem got his start in the legislature around the same time as Gilliam. His first memories of Gilliam were of him pointing to the public gallery and introducing people who weren't actually there.
He'd say, "I'm Madam Speaker, courtesies for why you tax me, he's here today." Stuff like that. And I was like, oh, that guy's funny.
Clem and Gilliam became fast friends despite their political differences. Their relationship even survived the time Clem campaigned for one of Gilliam's opponents.
He just has no punitive bone in his body. So he's effective because people, I think, respect him.
Clem knows what it's like to see someone close to him struggle with ALS. His mother-in-law died from the disease in 2014. That was also the year that Clem took part in the Ice Bucket Challenge, a popular fundraiser for the ALS Foundation. Clem's partner in the challenge? Vic Gilliam. Gilliam hammed it up on this YouTube recording. He's used to being on camera, because in addition to being a state lawmaker, Vic Gilliam is also an actor. You can even see him on an episode of Portlandia this season. Though, as Gilliam says,
"Don't blink or you'll miss my scene."
Gilliam appears during a dream sequence in which Fred Armisen's character frets about getting gray hair.
"Hey, little Freddy.
Uncle Manuel, hi.
What seems to be the problem?"
Gilliam says he's put his acting career on hold for now. Like his political career, it all depends on his ALS symptoms. The ALS Foundation says the typical survival time with ALS is 3 to 5 years after the onset of symptoms, but that some people can live 10 years or more. Gilliam says he's not focusing too much on what may or may not happen to him.
"I'm grateful for the years I've had, and I'm grateful for the years that I can see in the future with my family."
One sign of Gilliam's optimism? He's filed for re-election to another 2-year term in the Oregon House. I'm Chris Lehman in Salem.
That's all the time we have for today's edition of The Bridge. The Bridge airs weekly, Thursday mornings at 9. If you joined us late, you can listen to a podcast from our website at coastradio.org. Just click the program box on the homepage. We welcome your comments. Call us at 503-325-0010 or email to News1. That's NEWS and the numeral 1 at KMUN.org. I'm Kate Brister, saying thanks for listening today, and listen in again next Thursday for the next edition of The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.